So, Katharina Grigos has the honor to enlighten us with the opening lecture. Katharina is still fixing her computer. She's also an independent curator and art critic, and most of you will probably know her as the curator of Contour, the fourth Biennale of the Moving Image in Mechelen, already 1 year ago, that focused on the topic of historiography, artists giving their view on history and the way we remember it. And Contour, this show, by the way, also contained a lot of, included a lot of artists that experimented with the documentary format. Katharina Grigos is currently curating the show for the Danish Pavilion in the upcoming Venice Biennale that opens in June next summer, so I suggest you already save the date. The title of her lecture is Comparative Approaches to Recent Documentary Practice in Artists' Films, and that is exactly what we want to learn more about today. So please put your hands together for Katharina Grigos.
Thank you very much, Rob, and thank you for being here. I hope I'm able to introduce a certain moment of contemplation and introspectiveness after the rather disturbing clip that we just saw. You must forgive me if I sometimes speak too fast. I would like to say a little bit about what I'm going to say. I've entitled my talk The Elastic Documentary, which should give you a bit of an idea of what I'm thinking about, and I've separated it into three parts. So in the first part, if you'll permit me, I'll wax lyrical a bit, offering some kind of theoretical framework for the position that I'm going to take. In the second case, I would like to present some case studies. And for those of you who don't speak fluent English, I've tried to make your life a little bit easy by including some text in my PowerPoint presentation. And then hopefully, if I have time and people are not falling asleep, I'd like to show some excerpts of recent films that have in some way marked me. And I'd like to allow myself this position of subjectivity. So I'd like to start by saying that it's been a number of years that the so-called documentary turn has become a very frequent phenomenon in many artists' films. And I will, in fact, be talking about films made by visual artists today. This can be loosely traced back to Documenta 2002, which was curated by Okwi and Weser, and the inclusion of a large number of artists who attempted a connection with social and political reality and questions of historiography. However, it is my position that the development of this notion of the documentary in the last 10 years or so is not to be associated with a traditional definition of the documentary as a broad category of moving pictures intended to document some aspect of reality, presenting life as it is, directly capturing reality, and of course, representing it truthfully. And these ideas we mostly acknowledge as being problematic, since even the act of editing itself can be considered a form of doctoring or fabricating reality. And we also know, of course, that the concept of reality itself is very, very slippery. So against the tendency to regard the documentary as purely a matter of making images visible truthfully, this presentation seeks to diverge from the documentary as a fact or truth-based regime and to venture into the territory of the subjective. I'd like to look into certain selected documentary practices that thus transgress from the orthodoxy of documentary as factual film, a notion which many contemporary visual artists are challenging of late. And these artists are indeed working increasingly with the notion of the documentary, but as a point of departure, not necessarily with a view to intimating universal or absolute truths, but rather adopting what can be called a creative treatment of reality, one that can bring about another reality, a reality that might be more engaging, effective, or instructive than, let's say, the bare or raw reality that we experience in our daily lives. And these artists sometimes, and indeed not only sometimes, quite often, weave fictional elements into their work, demonstrating that truth value doesn't lie in mere representation, but may emerge, I believe, much more forceful through artistic abstraction, filtering, interpretation, and translation. It is a reality that can be more convincing and can provide more possibilities for empathy and understanding than a dry report of the so-called naive or raw reality. And I'll just take my watch off because I just want to be mindful of time. Okay. The work of these artists, a few examples of which I'll be showing further down, also demonstrates that nowadays the borderline between documentary and fiction or reality and fantasy is often becoming very hard to distinguish. And indeed, that maybe it's not productive to start talking about these separations, especially given the advent of new technologies and sophisticated digital manipulation, editing techniques, etc., etc. Indeed, directorial manipulation of documentary subjects has been noted since the very first documentaries, and one could say they might even be endemic to the form. I mean, a very, very early example of that would be Flaherty's 1921 documentary Nanook of the North, which documented an Inuit tribe in the Canadian Arctic, and one of the first criticisms that he received was that in order to make them appear much more authentic, he filled them. He asked them to be filmed in the act of hunting instead of using a gun, which is what they were doing, using a harpoon or a spear. So that kind of added this idea, the notion of authenticity, to what was in fact totally inauthentic. So I'd like to argue that the notion of this documentary reel in visual artist films is continuously evolving and cannot be pinned down to a single definition or categorized through strictly prescribed boundaries. The term documentary now encompasses a more diverse set of approaches than ever before, from factual films, hybrid films that include both found footage and original material, factual as well as fictional, reenactments, or abstract and elusive narratives. Which often results in highly subjective, poetic, and sometimes impressionistic quasi-documentary works, or what I would call documentary with a twist. Films that are often subjective reconstructions of marginal or repressed histories, counter-narratives to dominant forms of historical interpretation, the so-called master narratives. And indeed, in that respect, I would say that truthful testimony or the idea of witnessing are not, in this sense, a primary goal, as are, indeed, the problems of representation itself, the mechanics of representation, and questions of subjectivity. In these cases, the documentary is thus, more often than not, subjected to conditions of transformation. Through the documentation of reality by artistic artifice or reenactment, that is, through fictionalization or conflation of fiction and reality, something that has become very common in contemporary artists using film. Some might argue that these shifts have provoked a crisis in the documentary. I would argue that it has reinvigorated the practice, stretching its limits and resulting in a plethora of rich artistic positions. The blurring of categories such as documentary, art, and fiction does not attest to the failure of the documentary traditional art form, nor has it diluted the effectiveness of truth value, of the archetypally socially engaged or socially concerned or responsible documentary, but rather has opened up new alternative ways of intimating reality, and I want to stress that point, intimating as opposed to portraying or simply representing reality as we know it. In a recent book, the German artist and filmmaker Hito Steierl discusses what she calls the uncertainty principle, or the uncertain relation between representation and truth, as the fundamental determination of modern documentary practice. And I quote, "The perpetual disbelief, the gnawing uncertainty about whether what we see is true, faithful to reality or factual, accompany documentary images as their shadow. This doubt is not a deficiency, but the basic attribute of contemporary documentary images. Traditional documentary photography and film, furthermore, have been reinvented and reinvigorated by merging with other disciplines such as performance and conceptual art." Unquote. Recent documentary works in this vein attest to new diversity and new complexity of forms, ranging from conceptual mockumentaries to reflexive film and photo essays, from split screen and multiple screen video installation and slideshows to found footage reportage, and even films that in fact don't use the traditional notion of the moving image itself, one of which I'll actually show fairly shortly. Most of them are about searching for suitable forms and methods for discussing social content, whether historical material or effects of recent political and social upheaval. I will here focus on this elastic notion of the documentary by looking at some artists whose work narrative plays a key role, so I'll only be showing works with narrative content. In this definition of the documentary, the notion of realistic representation, i.e. the truthfulness of the image vis-à-vis that to which it refers, is no longer a primary criterion for many artists. A key example I'd like to begin with, and unfortunately footage of which I don't have to show you, is the Israeli artist Omer Fast, whose work is precisely based on this indistinction between fact and fiction. His seminal film, Spielberg's List, from 2003, is a two-channel video work that is constructed around the experience of Polish extras that participated in Steven Spielberg's Hollywood film, Schindler's List, and I'm sure quite a few of you have seen it. Spielberg shot his film on location in Krakow in Poland and used hundreds of local extras for the scenes involving the deportation, the camp, etc. He built up an elaborate stage set, a concentration camp, and this set was never completely dismantled, having since become a tourist attraction. So Omer Fast, in fact, traveled to Krakow, and there he located and interviewed survivors from Schindler's List, the film, and asked them to describe their experience and the scenes that they were in, often without elucidating upon the fact that the experiences that they were describing were, in fact, coming from the experience of being in a Hollywood movie. And here you can see one of these excerpts. So the video shows interviews of the extras in Spielberg's film without indicating whether those interviews are recounting stories about the fictional reality of the movie or the historical reality of the Second World War. Only very slowly does the viewer come to realize that these two things are in fact conflated and that those speaking themselves don't make a clear distinction between the two experiences. They recount both the horrors of the war and what is staged in the film, thus blurring the correct attribution of speaking positions. Fast here uses the standard documentary device of an interview in order to construct a narrative that has at its center, in fact, a paradox. And the actors, or extras, mix their real memories of the German occupation with those of the shooting in the film, though none of them was actually ever detained in a concentration camp, and none of them would thus be considered as occupying legitimate speaking positions about something that they in fact only witnessed in fiction and not in real life. So in that sense, their experiences can't be considered authentic. So what Fass does, in fact, is that he subverts the logic of the witnessing itself. But what I would like to argue is whether the essential truth value of what they recount is undermined. And I would say that it is not. Neither is the notion of empathy or affect that the film aims to engender. It's my position that sometimes fiction or a conflation of facts and fiction can provide much more insight and generate more empathy and affect than raw reality itself. And in fact, that is what the artifice of art is all about. According to the philosopher Jacques Rancière, representation in this sense is not to be understood, quote, as the regulation of the truthfulness of the mirroring of reality into artistic forms, but as the hierarchical system of regulations of what has to be shown and how. And this is precisely what Omer Fass does in this film. Now, I'd like to take that point a little bit further and to say that what is more at stake in works such as these is the idea of what I would like to call the distillation of reality, which may proffer truths in essence, but not unequivocally or absolutely. It is the reproduction of the meaning of an action or event and its translation into the present. It's re-actualization, very much in line with the old Aristotelian idea that art imitates nature, not by means of copying it, but by reproducing its sense, and its sense here being the operative word. In her excellent paper on Omer Fast, entitled When Images Lie, the German philosopher Maria Müller writes, "Realism has to be understood beyond the traditional oppositions between experience and abstraction, naturalness and artifice, or reality and fiction. As an aesthetic power of disruption of representations, significations, or the symbolic order, it opens up an aesthetic space where images, words, and things unfold their immanent power to signify. Spielberg's List is not the documentation of a Hollywood film and its critique, but the documentation of the disruptive power of fictions that materialize into things, dispositives, constructions, and memories of history that haven't been experienced." She calls this approach aesthetic realism, a term that I find very, very interesting and very, very appropriate for some of the work that I will also show. Something that emphasizes the impossibility to distinguish between fiction and reality. Aesthetic realism is not determined by the mimetic fidelity to the represented object, but instead refers to reality in a way that exposes it to a process of stylization and fictionalization. Consequently, realism and its strategies, such as reenactment or the documentary, emphasize a constitutively ambiguous relation to the notion of reality. An ambiguity that's in fact inherent to the notion of reality itself. And that is precisely what is at stake in Omer Fast's work. He not only blurs the documentary claim to truth and the fictional limitation to untruth, but he shows the absurd nature of this partition and its presupposition of a clear hierarchical distinction between facts, fictions, life, reality, and representation. His work, and particularly this important work, which I chose to present as a kind of reference point, in that sense, acknowledge and accept the notion of subjectivity in documentary, thus challenging its evidence-based and testimonial possibilities. In that sense, what one could say perhaps that the notion of docufiction is closer to many contemporary artists' practice than the pure notion of documentary itself. And docufiction, of course, refers to the cinematographic combination of fiction and documentary. The historical tendency of socially and politically engaged, and I would say of very recently, predominantly Western male documentary makers, to speak on behalf of their beleaguered or marginalized subjects was questioned as members of these spoken for communities have increasingly begun to speak for themselves. The acknowledgement of the failures and shortcomings of past documentary film strategies and styles, a recognition of the limits and the ethical problems of presenting documentary evidence, and the imposing voice of the privileged author has often resulted in filmmakers turning to new hybrid forms, self-reflexivity, parody, ambivalence, and sometimes also humor as a strategy of resistance. And this, I would say, is increasingly reflected in many visual artists working with film. It might be considered also a little bit old-fashioned, but I'd like to revisit pioneer documentary filmmaker John Grierson's definition of the documentary as the creative treatment of actuality. Grierson's theory of documentary film is, in fact, encapsulated in this very famous phrase. It was an aesthetic of primarily symbolic representation, what Grierson called the imagist or more definitely poetic approach, quote, the telling of a story or illumination of a theme by images, as poetry is a story or theme told by images, unquote. The notion of poetic reference to or creative treatment of reality was in part an attempt to move beyond actuality to a representation of what, for Grierson, was the real, a representation of the essence of things. And it is precisely this kind of essence, with the benefit of hindsight, of post-colonial, ethnographic, and anthropological studies, that many contemporary artists working with film and video today seem to be revisiting. The motivation for this so-called creative treatment of reality was not, however, exclusively aesthetic. From Grierson's social commitment came the idea of documentary as a means to an end. The idea that a mirror held up to nature is not so important as the hammer which shapes it. And he said, "It is a hammer, it is as a hammer, not a mirror, that I have sought to use the medium that came to my somewhat restive hand." An unmediated reflection of the world was not what Grierson aspired to producing. Rather, actuality had to be shaped and treated. By isolating an individual activity or event, the camera could reveal the inherent complexity of that event. For Grierson, documentary was essentially an adventure in observation, but one in which the crucial step was how one arranged those observations to reveal the real. Therefore, history and stories, documentary images and staged images, documentary images and staged or invented dialogues are each part of the same regime of truth. What one that does not aim at what I would say is the impossible mimetic reproduction of reality, but on the other hand aims at the very problematization of the notion of reality itself and looks at how this reality is represented. The fiction of the aesthetic age defined models for connecting the presentation of facts and forms of intelligibility that blurred the border between the logic of facts and the logic of fiction. Writing history and writing stories come under the same regime of truth, and this is a quote by Jacques Rancière also. As an ever-growing number of artists incorporate film and video into their practice, and the moving image has been more and more incorporated into the film and the gallery circuit, and indeed also the commercial art world, I would say that films made by artists in the visual art vein have also greatly influenced the current discourse surrounding the moving image and documentary practice, as these artists experiment with modes of filmmaking, in fact stretching the limits of the practice, and that's why I've decided to call this talk the Elastic Documentary. Through this experimentation and stretching of the boundaries, the distinction between narrative, avant-garde, and documentary filmmaking have become blurred, as have the ways that viewers experience film and video itself in variable surroundings. It is my view that the most interesting work these days occurs, in fact, on this borderline between fact and fiction, reality and fantasy, and that in order to communicate effectively, in order to function as art, such works have to function not only discursively, but also aesthetically. In the wake of shifts in the narrative approach of many of these documentary practices from the 1960s onwards, it would appear that the genre, if in fact we can call it such, lies somewhere in between the essay, the reportage, and the well-narrated story. It is marked not only by the first-person voice in testimonial or witnessing, but also by the bringing of the viewer into the world of the storyteller's experience. While it may be often socially engaged, it is not necessarily polemical. Indeed, it typically does not make a direct argument or may indeed not adopt a specific position, but makes an implicit request for the viewer to recognize the reality of the speaker and to bring that reality into our own worldview. Many artists are attempting to consider the complex moral and ethical lessons to be learned from contemporary anthropology about the politics of the gaze and the necessity to reverse the ethnographic gaze, empowering the other. In any case, to conclude my red part and to go on to something a bit more spontaneous, I strongly believe that the notion of artistic interpretation, filtering, or transformation of reality is often much more potent than this direct representation of reality itself. And I'd like to mention certain examples of films that somehow, in a way, encapsulate what I just... What I just mentioned. And some of the works that I'd like to mention are works that I've come into contact with recently or have worked with personally myself. And they're works which have moved me profoundly and also somehow deal with this notion of complexity and subjectivity that I just mentioned. The first one that I'd like to show is a rather complex six-screen video installation by the Finnish artist Eija-Liisa Attila, which is called Where is Where, and which I presented at Contour, the Biennial of Moving Image, which I curated last year. And the story is based on a real-life event which occurred in Algeria in the 1950s, at the time of French occupation. And the story revolves around three boys, two French boys and an Algerian boy. And the French boys, the two Arab boys, commit murder. And, of course, they're underage. So what Eija-Liisa Attila does is that she takes this true story and she fictionalizes it in this split-screen installation, somehow bringing into collision the past and the present. So she uses actors on the one hand, and she also introduces the figure of a female poet from the present day in Finland, where she comes from, to try and make sense of what has happened. So, in fact, the incident that is based on reality is taken out of its time and fast-forwarded into the present. And the reason that this is done is, of course, that both the poet and the viewer is trying to understand the relation, this very complex relationship between the past and the present, and these complex entanglements that, in fact, continue into time. But at the same time, it is a film that tries to put also the long-term conflicts between the Arab and the Western world into perspective. And lastly, I think most importantly, it also explores how the ghosts of the post-colonial and the specter of the post-colonial rises up to haunt the present, showing, in fact, its repercussion in present-day current affairs and history. This is a film by Lene Berge, a Norwegian artist, who was also in the Contour Biennial. The film is called Stalin by Picasso, and I'm going to show you a very small excerpt. And before I do that, I'd like to tell you just a little bit the story behind this film. In 1953, when Stalin died, Pablo Picasso, who was a member of the Communist Party, in fact a devout member of the Communist Party, was asked by the communist journal Les Lettres Françaises to make a drawing of Stalin as a tribute to the great leader. And in fact, so he did. Maybe I have an image. This is the drawing. When he did, and the drawing was published on the first page of Les Lettres Françaises, a huge scandal broke out because the drawing was seen to be unflattering to Stalin, even though that Picasso himself was a member of the Communist Party. And so the film that Lene Berg has made traces, in fact, this long-forgotten story to look at the reactions of all the actors, the cultural and the political actors at the time. And in fact, the film is also about revisiting notions of artistic appreciation and how these change over time. But it also, of course, reflects on cultural politics, power, propaganda, shifting artistic meanings, and the problems of translation that occur in our perception of art. What I find quite interesting about this film, and that's also the reason I'm showing it, is that, in fact, it doesn't include any moving images. It's a film which is exclusively made out of handmade drawings and collages made by the artist. So it's in fact incredibly lo-fi, but at the same time it's increasingly engaging. And when I talk about the artifice of art, I think this is a good example of this. On the other hand, I think it also is a very interesting reflection on subjectivity itself. And maybe we can show a very quick excerpt of that. Okay, sorry. It seems that we can't show any clips, but luckily I have some slides. The next film I'd like to talk about quite briefly, in fact, concerns a Belgian artist who I don't know whether he's with us, Vincent Mason, who, in talking about complexities and subjectivities, has in fact made one of the most multi-layered, complex films I've seen in a long time. The film is called Vita Nova. Can we switch off the soundtrack?
Of Comrade Picasso's portrait of the great Stalin.
Sorry, thank you. And Vita Nova takes as its point of departure the cover of the French magazine Paris Match from 1955. You can see a fragment of it here. And on this cover, a child soldier in the service of the French army is depicted in the act of making a military salute. So taking this particular image as his cue and as his point of departure, Vincent embarked on a search for this child soldier. There was, in fact, an article in the magazine, and this child soldier was one of a number of others that were featured. And embarks on a series of trips to Africa to find this child soldier, at the same time weaving a very, very elaborate narrative that raises the phantoms of the colonial past and brings also into the film the writing of Roland Barthes, who wrote about this particular image and in fact, critiqued the fact that it's subjugated negritude. And in the film, history, fact, fiction, artistic representation and artistic interpretation and reality are all interweaved into one very complex narrative. And the spectator is, in fact, trying to put together all these different fragments. And often the film is quite poetic. At other times, it's kind of more documentary. But it is, in fact, I would say, one of the most complex films that brings together all these strategies that I actually spoke about in my introduction. So the film, in fact, begins with a quest for the real and for a real character, so the child soldier. But in the end also gives life to another autobiographical story, that of the deceased Roland Barthes, revisited himself by the phantom of the post-colonial. And I won't speak too long because I only have 10 minutes left. But basically Barthes returns to the film in another body, this time a black body, haunted, in fact, by his own writing and his own history. And it transpires at the end that an aspect of his own suppressed history comes out because his own grandfather, Gustave Benger, was the first governor of the Côte d'Ivoire. So his whole family history was, in fact, implicated in the colonial adventure. I don't know whether I'll talk about this because I wanted to mostly show an excerpt of the film, but maybe I'll move on to another artist who I think has adopted a rather original approach into documentary practice, and it's a Dutch artist called Wendelin van Oldenborg. The film that I'd like to discuss is called Maurits Script, and a still of which you can see here. Wendelin has become quite known for organizing live film shoots which challenge the authorial voice of the documentary narrator and also the idea of a singular narrative perspective. So she organizes film shoots, live film shoots, in which active encounters between participants and performers become kind of conflated in one larger narrative. So the participants are also the performers, are also the translators of a specific text that is worked upon, read, exchanged, and interpreted. And thus, the traditional distinction between subject and observer is blurred. And Maurits Script, in fact, is based on a particular text, which is compiled on excerpts of several texts relating to Johann Maurits van Nassau, who was the first governor of the north of Brazil, and in fact considered one of the first enlightened modernist colonial rulers. And this particular film was also made live in the Golden Room of the Maurits House in The Hague, which was in fact built during the time of the governorship of Maurits himself. So Maurits Script, in a way, focuses on the paradoxes and inner conflicts produced both within the interpretation of a specific text, but also within the art of governing, allowing multiple voices and multiple cultural perspective to interpret questions of colonialism, identity, governance, and of course, ultimately highlighting the different subjectivities that govern all these. And here you can see just an excerpt of the film text. And this I also wanted to show, but for reasons of time, I will pass. I think I'll just focus on this last work, which is almost impossible to show, but which is in fact one of the most riveting film installations I've seen recently, and it's by the Indian filmmaker Amar Kanwar. It's called The Torn First Pages, and it is in fact a tribute to an anonymous bookseller from Burma who, as a personal act of resistance, decided to tear out the first page of every single book that he sold in his store. And in Burma, every book, the first page of every book has a short text that relates to ideological slogans and propaganda from the military regime. So Ko Tan Khtai, the book seller in question, tore out this page as an act of resistance, and Amar Kanwar made a film taking this event as a point of departure. He was, of course, the bookseller was eventually imprisoned. So it's a 20-channel video installation which revolves around the idea of resistance and the struggle for democracy, juxtaposing both forms of violence and forms of non-violence to talk about political exile, memory, dislocation, and human rights, in fact. And in this film, which is also, I think the installation is also quite interesting to mention, because while it deals with a very, very heavy subject, the projections themselves are actually projected onto paper, so they become almost ephemeral and ethereal. So basically what Kanwar does is that he takes this kind of very, very heavy material and he combines it with a kind of poetic expressivity in image and language. Focusing on the exploration of violence and the capacity of violence to intrude into every aspect of the private, the public, and the collective. There are various episodes. Some of them feature public protests. Other feature quests of political exiles. And the stories actually change from the private to the public. And also there are of course... there is footage also from violent encounters or violent episodes that gained the attention of the media maybe for a fraction of the moment and then are in fact reinvigorated and brought back into the public memory. And if you have the chance to see this film, these films, in fact, I would strongly recommend it. I think I'll wrap up there. In concluding, I'd like to say one thing, although I hope it has become apparent by the few works that I show that I consider quite indicative. In my point of view, some of the most interesting documentary practices that are being made today is, in fact, those practices which I call documentary with a twist. Films that interweave the political with the poetic, that navigate between different filmic categories to arrive at very subjective, highly individualistic, hybrid documentary forms where the notion of realism is in constant renewal and the idea of fact is always put into question. And I'd like to stop it there and hope that I'm in time. Thank you.